If you're hearing this, it means tickets are now on sale for our streaming Cybactacular.
That's what we're calling the streaming show of our Star Trek V review that we toured last year. We filmed our Hollywood show, and it's going to be streaming on Thursday, May 16th at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. And the stream will be available for a couple of weeks after that. If you can't watch right at the premiere time. A couple of pieces of information about this. If you support us at MaximumFun.org/join and your membership is current, check your email inbox because Maximum Fun will have emailed you a promo code to get $5 off your ticket. And also, we have some VIP packages available that include a meet and greet with me and Adam. Those are going fast, so jump on that if you want a meet and greet VIP package. Again, it's greatestgentour.com to get your tickets for the streaming Cybactacular.
My friends, the great experiment.
The greatest trick.
Ow!
Trick.
Would you look at that?
The greatest trick.
You people, you're all astronauts on some kind of Star Trek.
Welcome to Greatest Trek. It's a new Star Trek podcast from the makers of The Greatest Generation. I'm Adam Pranica.
I'm Ben Harrison.
We went back into the vault and dug this one out. We dug out a very special episode for you today.
Yeah, we've unearthed it.
Yeah. And in unearthing what we left behind, got me thinking a lot about the end of Voyager, Ben, and the documentary that's going to come out about that.
Yeah.
I wonder how much the producers of that film have watched this one. I mean, you learn a lot from watching a documentary like this if you're making a documentary of your own, right?
I think absolutely. And I think that there's a lot of ways in which this documentary is an unqualified success.
Sure.
And, you know, we went and saw it in such a fun environment, you know, seeing mm-hmm. it at the premiere. Yeah, so this is going to be a review that we recorded right after that. What We Left Behind is the documentary that's sort of, I guess, co-directed by Ira Stephen Bear.
Right.
And sort of starring Ira Stephen Bear as well, which is a creative decision that we talk a lot about in our episode. But yeah, like, I think that one interesting thing about Voyager is I don't think that there's as singular a force behind the show as Ira Stephen Bear was
sure.
behind DS9.
Yeah, I agree. And that might free it to make some interesting documentary decisions
yeah.
during production. I don't think we have a release date on that, but seems like it might coincide with the end of our run on Voyager on The Greatest Generation.
I swear we didn't plan it that way.
Yeah. At the time we recorded this, it wasn't super easy to watch this documentary, but now it's available on Peacock and Amazon and YouTube and all that. So should be findable. Definitely recommend you see it if you're a fan of Deep Space Nine.
Yeah, would recommend the movie to any Deep Space Nine fan and would recommend listening to this special bonus episode.
Oh, yeah.
That we
voice crack. Oh, yeah.
That we pulled out from the vault. And, you know, like these are examples of things in the bonus feed. If you've enjoyed hearing a couple of things that were behind the paywall before, maybe consider giving us a little bit of support. We record a new bonus episode of one kind or another every single month for supporters of Greatest Gen and Greatest Trek.
And we love doing it.
It's, say that in a way that makes me feel like you don't actually. But Adam's weird sarcastic tone aside, we do.
I was being sincere, Ben. You, like most people in my life, can't tell the difference, no matter how close we are. But yeah, big fun every month. Hope to see you in the bonus feed.
It sure is. Well, we're going to go have some chamomile tea or some throat coat or something and enjoy this lovely episode.
Here's to the finest crew in Starfleet. Engage.
Captain Jean-Luc Picard of the USS Enterprise.
Commander Benjamin Sisko, Federation Starbase, Deep Space Nine.
Welcome to The Greatest Generation, a Star Trek podcast by a couple of guys who are a little bit embarrassed to be bringing you this special donor bonus documentary edition of their Star Trek podcast. I'm Ben Harrison.
I'm Adam Pranica.
We saw it. Everybody has asked, are you aware that this exists? We are.
We're so aware. We were invited to its premiere, Ben, but you got to go, huh?
I did, yeah. I went with our buddy Ben Fritz, the premiere date that we share amongst ourselves.
Yeah.
You watched it on like a Vimeo link that the PR company sent, right?
Yeah, I bought tickets to a screening, which was happening up in Seattle, but I didn't end up going.
You hate getting recognized in public.
That was not the reason that I did not go. I couldn't make it, but luckily we were working with the PR company who was doing work ahead of the Fathom Events event for this movie. And for a while, we were going to do something with them, but that didn't end up happening.
Yeah.
What did happen is they gave us a screening link for the movie, and that is how I watched it instead.
Well, there's worse outcomes could have happened.
Yeah. What was your experience at the premiere itself? Was it red carpet? Like, this was obviously in LA, so like were stars there? Was Ira there? What was the deal?
Ira was not there. I think Ciroc Lofton was there. Aaron Eisenberg was there. Nicole DeBoer was there. A few others were definitely in the room, but I kind of missed there was like a group of people up on the stage who introduced the film, but I got there a little late. Here's the thing, Adam. This was at the, I think it's like the TCM Chinese Theater now, but it used to be the Grohmann's Chinese Theater.
Yeah.
So like, when I heard that it was going to be there, I'm picturing like, you know, it's going to be like the Hollywood premiere that you've seen at the Grohmann's Chinese Theater in the movies, right?
It's people pushing hands into wet concrete.
Yeah. And I went, and this is like the theater in LA where like people dress up as superheroes and try and get you to take a photo with them and stuff.
Yeah.
And so I went and I was like standing out in front of it for a while. And our buddy Ben Fritz was like texting me like, "Hey, where the fuck are you?" And I was like, "I don't know. I'm like at this theater." And he's like, "Yeah, but it's on the third floor in like a normal theater. You just have to come up here." So
you had thought this was an event. But
yeah.
It was really like kind of just a screening.
Well, it was a screening except for it was run by Fathom Events. Mm-hmm. So there was like after the movie was over, they then had a panel, except for it was on video, with the producers of the movie and Ira Stephen Bear talking about, you know, what it took to put the movie together. And specifically, they spent most of the 15 minutes of that talking about what it was like to digitize and color correct the original 35mm negatives from the show for presentation in a movie context.
Did most people stick around for that?
It seemed like a lot of people stick around. There was kind of a funny moment because I was getting, I forget what it was, but there was somebody was texting me something that I needed to reply to kind of urgently during that part of the screening. So like the movie was over, but like pretty much everybody stayed in their seats and like the lights never came up. But I got up to like run down to like be in the little vestibule so that when I turned my phone on to reply to the texts I was getting, I wouldn't bother people.
That's considerate.
And I think when I stood up and like walked down, it like made people realize, oh, I can just go. So like easily a dozen people got up and left when I did that.
Wow. Are you usually the first to do things in a group? That had to feel good.
I don't know. Yeah, it felt like one of those like psychology experiments you hear about in college classes, you know?
Yeah.
Like, oh, you go into a elevator and you face the back wall and it flips people out.
You really did your own Stanford prison experiment there, right there in the audience, Ben.
Yeah. So then there was, I guess, a panel with a bunch of cast members after that even, but...
Which was neither... live in the room or another...
Yeah.
Yeah. Video. And, oh, okay.
Neither Ben nor I had eaten anything, so we went and hit the Cabo Wabo Cantina rather than stick around for the panel.
Awesome. So how was Cabo Wabo?
It was great. I had chicken fajitas. I believe Ben had a vegetarian burrito.
As he does. Yeah. That's great. I love Ben Fritz. He's a great friend of DeSoto. Yeah, hell of a friend to us.
One of the top guys. And it was very fun to hang out with him and see the movie with him. What did you think of the documentary?
You know the greatest danger facing us is an irrational fear of the unknown.
It's merely a documentary.
Beginning on like a macro level, I am glad this exists as a document. I feel like it feels a little rare to get a chance to celebrate a thing that hasn't been made for 20 years, you know?
Yeah.
And so the idea that this thing even exists, full stop, I think is great.
Yeah, I agree with that. As well, one thing that was said in the panel, the video panel that I did see after the movie was the producer had approached Ira Stephen Bear at like one of the Vegas cons about being the director of it.
Uh-huh.
Like they had already kind of started the process of assembling media and starting to kind of make the movie, and then he approached him and he put it in terms of, like, do you want to be the William Shatner of this documentary? And I thought that was, like, kind of unintentionally apt in a way.
Yeah.
Because Shatner has made so many movies about Star Trek and, like, reexamining it in a bunch of different ways. But he's always made himself the middle of it.
Right.
Like, the most important figure in Star Trek.
Yeah.
And I thought it was, like, as somebody who is trying to make a documentary and who has a bit of a public persona, like, it's tempting sometimes to, like, make yourself the center of attention. But, man, I really didn't love the idea that the director was also, like, on screen the most and espousing his opinion about the show the most.
Yeah, I will say that the degree to which you like and care about and care for Ira Stephen Bear, I think goes a long way towards whether or not you like this documentary.
Right.
Because of that. I mean, and I think just on a foundational level, as someone who has dabbled in documentary himself, like I have zero impulse to be a part of the stories that I tell. And it is like, I feel like there is a creative fraternity of people, and this is a group that you and I belong to that, you know, enjoy the creating the thing and then making the thing separate from themselves. Like the thing stands on its own.
Right.
And I think the quality of the thing that is made should be such that it does not require or need the creator of the thing to be a part of it. It's like growing up a kid or something. Like you want it to walk off on its own and be successful without you. And it's weird that there's this like through line where this documentary cannot exist without Ira Stephen Bear. And
right.
and he lets you know that every 5 minutes.
Yeah. I mean, I think that this all like is perhaps most crystallized by his presence as the only face on the poster.
Yeah.
It fucks the poster up.
It does, and it's too bad because, you know, he says at the end how much of his goal was to, you know, at first he was like, I want to canonize the actors who worked so hard on this show, and then as soon as I started making the doc, I wanted it to be about all the production people who made the show possible. Like, it's weird that you get that as an epilogue to the film. Because his face is all over the poster and is woven throughout the film inextricably. Like, it doesn't work to say that after the film is over. Like, hey, by the way, this is all about other people, guys, and I really need you to know that. That just rings as a little bit hollow.
Yeah.
And this, I don't want this to come across as like kneecapping Ira Stephen Bear, because again,
no, we're not. Yeah.
Glad the movie exists. Glad that he made it. I think,
I like it too.
Yeah.
Like,
and I also like the movie. Yeah, absolutely.
What did you think about all the kind of production elements, like the Max Gradenchik singing and having Andrew Robinson kind of like, you know, break the fourth wall a whole bunch of times?
I liked Andrew Robinson throughout this documentary. I thought he was great. I mean, where he did the phone call to Ira, I thought was fun and funny. But like, there's like a main element to Star Trek of this era, of the early to late 90s to early 2000s era, is a thick slice of cheese. And this film makes you remember that in its bookends. And while I didn't personally like the show tune beginning and end,
I thought the opening one was a lot stronger than the one they ended on.
What it does is it puts you in a place and a time where this was what Star Trek did. And it definitely stopped me from like wincing in in like, oh no, like sometimes you'll start a movie, and this goes for any movie, like a movie that starts before the credits, you're like, ah, oh, is this what we're gonna be in for?
Yeah.
But it wasn't like that. It was a more conventional documentary after that. What about you?
I liked the...
Nothing rhymes with operations team, Ben. Like, that's right. Like the lyrics to the song are fucking insane.
Enough said. Enough said.
The greatest trick is yet to come.
I wanted to talk a little bit about the... There's a fairly long exploration of what happened to Terry Farrell in this film that I think tiptoes up to without directly saying that Rick Berman basically told her she was lucky to be there, but she, like, nobody names names.
Right.
And she comes across as still being very, very hurt by the way it happened.
I didn't want to die, but there was a point where it was like, you know what? Don't dismiss me.
It made me wonder, like, this documentary was not funded by the Star Trek Industrial Complex. Rick Berman, not a producer of this documentary. If there was ever a time to tell the whole truth about that situation, why doesn't Ira do that here?
Right. And why is Rick Berman treated with the kid gloves he's treated with? Like we've learned a lot about some other, like, uncomfortable situations with him over the years, and it seems like he just gets to be like a normal guy who is nice and doesn't get named in that episode in this film.
Like, what are the future job prospects that Ira Stephen Bear is protecting by not going after Rick Berman full-throated?
Yeah.
It seems related to the fear that people feel for calling out sexual harassment in the workplace.
Right.
You know,
right.
If Ira Stephen Bear can't do that, then who else is going to be able to do that in Hollywood?
Yeah. He has a position of privilege and power that he does not use for good in that specific moment.
The film kind of doesn't make Terry Farrell look good in that either, because, you know, the emotional sine wave of the film stays very above the line. It, for the most part, you get either the joy of a reunion or the sadness of a good thing being over with.
Right.
But Terry Farrell's emotional currency in the film is one of hurt, and her tears are of a deeper kind of sadness that seems... There's an incongruency with her and the rest of the film and the cast that's in it that, like, I don't want to use the vocabulary of social justice warriordom, but, like, it others her in that way, in a way that was uncomfortable and unfortunate.
Yeah. Like, I'm glad it's addressed. I'm glad that it's in there to spark conversation. And I just feel like the film could have taken it a little bit further, you know, close the loop on it, you know, say what really happened.
Yeah. God. Cause you just, I mean, there's not going to be another one of these.
No.
You know, like, this is the last chance to really do it. I wonder, you know, I don't know what your credit sequence was like on the screener. There was a fairly developed scene where Nana Visitor and Ira were on screen, and they were like, check out the special features. There's going to be a lot of things that we couldn't include in the film. I wonder to what degree any of that stuff will be seen as an extra. I don't know. I don't have my hopes up for that.
One part of the movie that I thought was pretty interesting was, you know, like, this is in a lot of ways an act of self-lionization, but they do make some attempts to do some self-criticism as well. And like, he sits down with an editor at one point and talks about like issues of representation and where they did well and where they did poorly. And he talks about LGBT representation, you know, not having been as good in this show as he feels like it should have been. And, you know, with the notable exception being that Garrick is sort of coded as gay, but they never come out and say it explicitly.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and then there's that one episode where Dax reconnects with a previous love, and it's and they have the same sex kiss, but that's also, you know, there's some alien hand waving around that can kind of explain it away.
I mean, I'm glad that Ira and gang are self-aware enough to recognize, you know, areas of improvement.
Yeah.
But this speaks to the core of how this documentary was constructed. I wish Ira Stephen Bear sat down for a conventional interview instead of, clearly what I saw was like he did a pre-write. He wrote a scene
that was
for himself
scripted.
Where he could come out looking thoughtful. And I think scripted thoughtfulness reads as far, far different from interview thoughtfulness. And I thought the second type would have been a better look for him.
Yeah.
The greatest trick.
One thing that they do highlight in the movie that I think they deserve credit for is that the female characters on this show really have agency and like perspective and like and do shit, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, and I think that there's obviously examples to the contrary, inevitably, but but when they go down the list of like, you know, Keiko, Kai Winn, like everybody with like a recurring speaking part is an interesting character who has her own agenda and who pursues it. And yeah. I thought that was a really cool, it was a really cool thing to reflect on, given how critical we've been of TNG and how underwritten the female characters tended to be on that show.
That montage, though, felt like it was done such through the male gaze, though, because, like, you can't play that Meredith... Like, if a woman had produced and directed this documentary, I don't think she uses the Meredith Brooks song for that moment.
Yeah. No, and like, speaking of, like, missing a cue, like, they do spend the entire time talking about, like, you know, that there were lots of important black characters on the show, and you could occasionally have, you know, scenes where three black characters were talking to each other, and yet it was never considered like a black show.
Yeah.
And they talk about, you know, women and all the like representational boundaries they pushed with this show. And then the whole documentary is structured around a writer's room meeting of a bunch of white guys, bunch of straight white guys.
Yeah. Yeah.
What did you think of that episode one of season eight episode they sketched out?
I gotta say, I really enjoyed it. This is an experience that I've always wanted. Like, you and I joke all the time about very early in season one of Star Trek Discovery, we were like, I want to be in there. I want to be a part of this creative team.
Right.
Like, to see how this sausage gets made. I thought it could have been a larger part of the documentary. I really loved seeing all that stuff get done. And I enjoyed the story they were constructing. It seemed to make sense given the time that had passed between the last episode and now. I think for a day's work, especially, I think they did a good job. And I thought, like, I've always written for Ron Moore, like, as a story guy. It did not surprise me that Ron Moore's ideas were my favorite ideas in that room. I thought he did a great job.
The lesson is, when you don't pay us, we do faster, better work.
Yeah, there you go.
I loved how that was edited also, because it's not, it doesn't overwhelm the documentary, but that's obviously shot over the course of 8 hours or something.
Yeah.
And they do a great job of showing you the process, showing the back and forth without it dragging the way an actual workday drags.
And they show you how nonlinear story creation is, because there are people talking about the end of the episode and the beginning of the episode when the whiteboard is still clean.
Yeah.
So they're kind of circling their target a little bit at the beginning before they finally dive in. I thought it was a really fascinating thing to watch that happen.
One other thing that really kind of I mean, like, it's one of these things that I kind of know intellectually, but this documentary really made me feel was the way, like, receiving criticism feels is just a part of life as a creative person. Because when they are talking about, like, the hate mail that they got and the critiques that they received, the way they expressed their feelings about it felt very, very similar to what it feels like to me to read, like, a one-star review of our show on Apple Podcast.
Sure, and it made me think a lot about the criticisms that we've leveled against this show, you know, and how hard we try to make sure that where there are areas to criticize, we are not cruel about it.
Right, that we're not being unduly negative or negative because it's not the thing we like, but trying to... I mean, I think there's a, like, there's a big difference between shitty internet comment and writing a movie review in The New Yorker, you know?
Right.
And I would like to be much closer to that end of the spectrum, the professional criticism end.
Yes, The New Yorker.
The New Yorker, but with fart jokes and dongers.
Boy, what did you make of the Carrie McCluggage executive character?
This is the whitest man in the world with the cable knit sweater wrapped around his shoulders.
He is such a reminder of who is at the top in these circumstances. And he's also a stark reminder of how little self-awareness there is at a certain altitude, you know?
He, like, did not seem to mind saying that they didn't want Sisko to read as street on camera. Like, he didn't seem embarrassed about saying that.
He's a guy who said, do the interview in my parlor room with the grand piano in the back. Set up your lights while I go tie a sweater around my neck. Like, that just seems like a person who does not know who his audience is. And he's, like, a man who made decisions for audiences that he didn't know.
You know that that guy has, like, a putting setup just off camera, right?
Yeah. I, you know what? I don't know him, and so I can't loathe him. But for as off as he came off on the screen, I kind of wanted him to be a bigger part of this. Like, I wanted...
Right.
I kind of wanted to know more about what makes a person like that tick for some reason.
Yeah.
Because he seemed so incongruent with everything else happening in the episode, and yet crucial to understanding why certain decisions were made.
Yeah, and I thought it was really interesting to kind of see where, like, the level at which some of those decisions get made. Like, oh, I don't know if we can have a starship be a part of Deep Space Nine. Like, I don't know about the Defiant being something that is being discussed at the network level.
Yeah.
It is such
wild.
A surprising idea.
A guy who's making decisions for dozens of television shows sees that and has to make the call. It's so weird.
That is now your chair, Captain.
It's a new ship.
One thing that I could have also used a lot more of, Ben, was Avery Brooks.
Yeah.
You know, I'm glad they had a lot of good archival footage to use, and the interviews about Avery Brooks of the other cast members were an interesting way to get to know him. What a fascinating guy.
Yeah, he almost seems like Pootie Tang, like that bit about how, like, he doesn't always even use English.
Yeah, he really seems like a great director of actors. Like, the
Seriously.
Affection that the rest of the cast shows for him as a director. Like, I feel like a few times, Siroc Lofton talks about what it was like to act with him and be friends with him, which it sounds like a very powerful relationship to have.
Yeah.
But for the most part, everyone else talks about him as a director and what a gift that must be to an actor to have someone... with that kind of, like, emotional capacity and
right,
and
it's, like,
acting
so
experience.
Disproportionately connected to the emotional end of what a director does that, like, they also have, like, people from the crew who are like, we didn't know what the fuck was going on most of the time when he was directing.
Yeah, that AD was like,
I need to like actually talk to you. Like we actually need to function as a crew. And like the first AD is the director of everyone, even more so than the director themselves, because the director primarily is working creative stuff with the actors. And so for there ever to be a moment where he was not in sync with the first AD was a shock to me.
Yeah.
Like, wow, how do you function as a production that way? That was fun. And it was not played for, like, you could play that as like, whoa, eccentric Avery Brooks, like being a weirdo, but it was never that kind of thing. It was always like Avery Brooks is sort of a genius. And what you needed to do was like, try to understand.
Right. Like get on his level, man.
Yeah. Yeah. And I know he's tired of talking about this stuff, and believe me, I think we both have an understanding of what it's like to have your identity tied to a thing that is just one part of who you are, you know?
Right, yeah.
And I get that, but I would like to hear more from him at some point. Maybe he'll be ready to talk again down the road. I hope so.
I hope so, too. Speaking of how challenging the production was, one thing that I have not been able to stop thinking about since seeing the film is the idea that when they were in production, their days were 12 to 18 hours a lot of the time.
Yeah.
And how fucking harrowing that is, how brutal that is. Like, especially the people in Loaf getting there like 3-4 hours ahead of everybody else so that they can get in makeup and then working all day in that like super, super hot. Like, it's basically like having a coating of rubber all over your body, you know?
It makes me wonder, and this is an answer that we could probably get from the actors in our listening community, but is a person genetically predisposed to not having terrible acne after wearing Loaf around for 18 hours a day every day for 6 months? Because a certain type of actor, it would seem, would not be able to be an actor on a show like this because their skin wouldn't allow it.
Right.
It's incredible.
Yeah. I don't know the answer to that. And I mean, as a person who almost never wears any makeup of any kind, unless I'm on camera for something, which has happened almost never, just putting some makeup on feels like, God, this is like putting stuff on your face seems wrong.
Yeah.
You know? But yeah. Like, and I know that's obviously a super subjective reaction to that. Like, I'm very far toward one end of the spectrum on that. But like having Klingon Loaf all day and like having to eat food that my Klingon teeth can accommodate is something else entirely.
Yeah. Rene Auberjonois mentioned that it sort of affected his reputation around the set. You know, when you're a Loafed actor, you can't eat like the rest of the actors on the crew. You can't treat yourself to things that a non-Loaf would.
Right.
He felt ostracized, but it was like of his own doing, you know?
Right.
I thought that was an interesting bit.
I can't go hit In-N-Out Burger with you guys because I'm in Loaf.
Yeah. Yeah. And that was too bad. I mean, he's no less loved by the rest of the cast. I think some of my favorite parts of the doc were, you know, they were clearly there doing some photo shooting and like the Beverly Hills 90210-ification of like getting the gang together and shooting stills and like doing like poses and stuff. Like they all clearly have so much affection for each other. It was really nice to see.
It was really fun. You know, the thing that I have described this documentary as to friends who've asked about it is it felt to me a lot like a Star Trek convention in a box.
Yeah.
Like this is what the panels at a convention feel like.
Yeah.
You know, just kind of telling some old stories and you know, better edited than that, obviously. But
you really wish sometimes you could bring an editor to a Star Trek convention.
You really do.
I know I do.
but all told, I think a very worthy love letter to a great show.
Yeah, I think so too. I liked it a lot.
I am very curious to see what those special features hold.
Yeah.
I think we can probably end it there, huh?
Yeah, I think so too. I don't think we're above doing a documentary review on our show. This is
fun. Yeah, let us know if you liked what we did here. And, you know, I think one of the things we should encourage people to do on these donor bonus episodes is let people know if you liked it online, because, you know, sometimes people donate and then don't always check the donor feed. So
right.
We need help getting the word out when donor bonus episodes drop, but also secretly, like, it could be good encouragement for people to become donors, you know?
That's
I want to check out those special eps. And if you feel like these special eps are, you know, an added value, well, first of all, thank you for supporting our show. And second of all,
definitely,
you know, mentioning that online helps us grow the number of people that are supporting it. So
that's right. Your support gives us the time and the interest in going out on a limb like this. So thanks. Yeah.
Thank you.
Maximum Fun,
a worker-owned network
of artist-owned shows.
Supported
directly
by you.